Coming up on today's episode of Coding 101, Randall Schwartz and his pearls of wisdom. Get it?
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Coding 101 is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
Welcome to Coding 101. It's the show where we teach you the secrets of the Code Monkey. I'm Father Robert Ballasaire.
And I'm Shannon Morris, and we have tons of awesomeness for you today, and I am super excited about our guest interview.
Absolutely.
But first, why are we doing an interview?
Well, remember, when we started Coding 101, we thought that we needed something between the modules, right?
Yes.
We didn't just want to go from teaching X language to teaching Y language. We wanted to give people a break to sort of reset and maybe clear out the taste of the last language. And more importantly, we wanted to give you something to look at as to why you're actually learning how to program. So we're going to bring in visionaries. We're going to bring in CEOs. We're going to bring in experienced programmers who show you what they do with their coding knowledge. And who do we have this week, Shannon?
This week, I'm super excited about this because I'm kind of a fan. This is Randall Schwartz with his pearls of knowledge. I just like saying that because I think it's hilarious.
Cool.
Hi, Randall. How are you?
Randall Schwartz, the host of Floss Wednesday, the earliest show on the TWiT TV network. Thank you so very much for coming.
Oh, yeah, and actually, I got to sleep in a little bit today, too, which is really nice. So,
nice.
Time for my earlier show. Yeah, no, great.
We don't do sleep.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, we don't do sleep.
Yeah, we never sleep here.
No. Well, the reason why we asked you to come in is because you are one of the acknowledged experts in Perl, right? I mean, you've written a series of books about Perl. You teach Perl. You talk about Perl. And more importantly, you program in Perl.
Well, I program in a lot of languages, but Perl's maybe the most money over the last 25 years. Exactly. I wrote the top five selling best selling books and the 255 magazine articles. And yes, I ran a training company that was extremely busy during the late 90s as the dot-com boom rolled out. It's not so much, it's much more in mothballs now because there aren't 20 people wanting to learn something about Perl sitting in one place for a week anymore. So I don't do much of that. Perl's only like one of the 70 languages I list on my resume. So I've got plenty else to talk about besides Perl, too.
Well, yeah, let's back off because it's easy to talk about a single language, especially if it's one that's close to your heart. But we want to go beyond that. We want to talk about what actually brought you into programming in the first place, because there are a lot of people who are trying to get into this game who are seeing these multi-billion dollar deals for apps and saying, look, I've got a good idea. How do I program it? What was the catalyst for bringing you into the world of the programmer?
Well, I've got to say it's my father, and I've said this before in interviews, and I really appreciate that. He had a really strong work ethic. He said, you know, son, you're going to have to grow up someday and get a job. And so I figured, okay, I got to find something I'm good at. And he was also a tinkerer. So we had the lab that we would share time in where you'd assemble stuff that was on the cover of Popular Electronics magazine back in the early 70s and stuff. And it was great being with him. I found, though, that I had a propensity both for the electronics and for math. I kind of like math in school. And so one day, Dad brought home a bunch of books on computer programming. And I started reading one of these books, and it was on a sort of digital equipment corporation called Focal. And so I read this whole book all the way through, and I started writing stuff that was similar to what I was seeing in the book. And I ran down to the lab where Dad was, and I held up the book, and I held up this piece of paper, and I said, this is what I want to do. I want to express problems as a series of steps. And he says, okay. And so a few weeks later, I come home from school. I was just, I think I was like 10 at the time. Yeah, about around 10. I come home from school, and there's this book on time-shared basics sitting on the table. And Dad was off on a service call, so I didn't get to see him right then. But Mom said, go read this book. And Dad says, that's for you to look at. And so I read all the way through the book, and I start writing basic programs on paper again. And still having no access to any real computers. I mean, you got to remember, this is 1971, okay? So really early days, right? And so 71, 72, somewhere in there. And so Dad comes home and says, do you think you understand that? And I said, yeah, I can write programs in that, I'm pretty sure. And he says, well, this Saturday, got a surprise for you. And it turns out he'd gone to the high school nearby where I lived and arranged for the computer teacher to spend his Saturdays with me.
No way.
So the first day I walk in there, you know, I'm like 10, maybe I might be 11. I may be mixing up the years now, but somewhere really early on. And the first day, the guy introduces himself, and he sees that I'm holding the Timeshare Basic book, and I said, and we're sitting in front of an ASR 33 teletype, uppercase only, 110 baud, you know, this is classic old stuff, right? And he says, well, let's start with page one. I go, well, can I just type in this program and see if it works? And I had this whole 100-line program that was type one to add, two to subtract, three to multiply, four to divide.
Wow.
And then it would ask for the two numbers, then do the operation, then go back to the beginning of the loop. And I typed it all in, and my very first program had no bugs. It worked perfectly, and it blew the socks off of the poor computer teacher. And but that fall, for like probably 10 weeks in a row, I was down there playing with this ASR33 teletype, typing in basic programs that I was inventing at the time. And from there, I actually ended up at that school on the 2 years later. And I was like, mornings before school, I was in that little tiny ASR33 teletype room. And then for lunch every day, I was there. For 2 hours after school every day, I was there. I'd found books on the programming language. So I brought in, you know, programs to type in. And I wrote a lot of my own stuff. And I looked at everybody else's code, shared stuff around like that. And by the time I got into high school, I was actually teaching the programming classes. I knew more than that computer teacher. It was a different school that I got moved to. So... also during my high school phase, I ended up working. In 1977, I wrote my first program for hire and got paid $30 an hour at age 15.
Wow.
So it was like I knew this is where I wanted to go. I didn't go to college. I went immediately from there into the working world and spent 7 years at three different companies. And then I've owned my own company for, I think it's 27 years now, 28 years, something like that. So. Yeah, so that's the early phase, and hopefully that answered most of your question.
Oh, Randall, that tells us how you got into it, and I think Web4242 in the chat room right now is saying, "Look, well, Randall has the tinkerer gene." I think that's true. I mean,
he does.
that's how our generation kind of learned programming because no one else was doing it. There were no courses in how to program when I grew up. It was just if you wanted to play with computers, you got it. And you found some way to learn how to do it, and you tried to make it do something.
There were courses for me, but it wasn't until high school that I was able to actually do things like that. So for me, it was a lot like you. My dad was really supportive of my interest in computers, so he brought home a computer and he brought home some books. And he just said, here, go at it. If you like this stuff, just keep at it, and one day you'll make a career out of it. That's really cool. I like hearing that, you know, parents are supportive of what you do.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I've got to say, it's there are people who try to get into programming thinking that, well, if they don't have this tinkerer gene, that they can sort of learn it. But it's sort of like forcing yourself to paint by numbers and still calling yourself an artist. And I see that all the time, you know, when I'm hiring people, a lot of times as a consultant, I'm brought in to sort of interview people that are going to be filling the jobs that are around me. So I get a lot of being on that side of the desk for hiring people. And I see people who I really wish they weren't in programming, you know, and I don't mean that with any disrespect, but there's probably something that they can do much better. But especially we saw this in the late 90s with the .com, original .com gold rush, is that there were a lot of people getting into, particularly Perl, that didn't belong there. And so a lot of bad Perl code was written, a lot of bad PHP code still continues to be written. And it's by people who aren't quite there. You know, if you're not naturally driven to be a programmer, I would advise you to stay away. And I don't mean that because I don't want competition. I'm just saying it's better for all of us.
Well, I have a question for you. You mentioned that your very first program that you ever wrote, it worked flawlessly. It was perfect.
Yes.
How did it make you feel when you got your first error? Because I know for me, it was extremely aggravating and it took me a really long time to fix.
I don't put bugs in programs. No, actually, it's weird. I program very incrementally. So I'll take even a large application, if I'm trying to change to do something new, I'll only add like two lines of code that I understand exactly what's going to happen as an interface with that. And if I'm surprised by that, I go, well, why was I surprised? So then I put in some more debugging print statements, stuff like that. But I debug by adding print. That's really the only way I'm ever going to debug. I don't like real debuggers. I don't like IDEs. I don't like any of that stuff. I'm an Emacs guy, and I'll code in Emacs all day. And but I'm very careful to only add a little teeny bit of feature and functionality, and then I run it again, and a little more functionality, and run it again. Perl, of course, is really good at that. My latest new language that I'm really getting the kick out of is Dart, and that also does the same sort of thing. You add a few lines, and you run. Now, it has an IDE, and it can tell me how to autocomplete, you know, what method calls I can make on these things. But I find that doesn't really help me all that much. I kind of already know what the object is going to be in that variable, and I already know kind of the method calls I want to make on it. So having an IDE that manages that doesn't gain a lot for me.
You know, Randall, when I was still working in the industry, I used to hear an analogy a lot of it was sort of like a kitchen. A good programming shop was run like a kitchen where you may have one or two, maybe even three in a small shop, individuals who actually know how to program. They have the passion for it. They were bitten by the bug. They've got that tinkerer gene. They're the ones who come up with the roadmap. They know how X suite, X piece of software, X piece of code should work. And then it was okay as long as you had those chefs, those five-star chefs in your shop, in your kitchen, to have programmers who maybe had the technical aptitude but not the passion. You know, they're not the ones who will naturally try to figure out 15 different ways to do the same thing. They just want to make it work. And that if you have a shop like that, then it's okay to have people who may be good at coding but don't have, as you said, that natural knack for it. Would you agree or disagree? Would you say no, everyone who's programming needs to have that natural, innate way to program?
No, I agree with you there. I think in a large shop, it's fine to have, you know, two or three really, you know, leaders, people who have been programming since 10 or even earlier now. I didn't have the opportunity to go even earlier than that. I think as long as you have a few people like that there, the risk, though, is that if you have two or three people like that and one of them is thinks that they're brilliant and likes to keep demonstrating that, then you actually have a negative space instead of a positive space. But if you have two or three people who are willing to share, willing to even have their own code reviewed, which says a lot about a person. Now, you know, if I'm willing to have every line of code that I commit to our repository reviewed by other people, which I still am, because I miss things occasionally, you know. I'm typically hired for a period of 6 to 12 months at a company to come in and make everything go faster or better or make everything more reasonable, whatever. And I don't necessarily know all the coding conventions they might have. Like the reason they have this set of subroutines is because they want to talk to this particular device in a certain way. And if I publish code that I've made a change in, I'm not up on all the local nuances, the folklore we like to call it, within the company, then I need to have that code reviewed. So first thing I do when I go into a new company is establish a protocol, which is like, look, you look at my code, I'm looking at your code. You know, that's just how it's going to be before we start shipping it live.
Let me ask you a little bit about that, because as a consultant, as someone who actually comes in and puts out fires and makes things work when things were previously broken, mm-hmm. I know sometimes it can be difficult to come into a team that's already been established. You know, you've got the cook. You've got the hierarchy of how it's supposed to go. You mm-hmm. come in because typically there's either a deadline that needs to be met or because things aren't going as they should go. And when you sit down and you establish that protocol, you've got to get a lot of blowback, right? I mean, these are people who aren't used to having someone look over their code. These are people who aren't used to having peer review of what they've written. What do you need to be able to do that? Because at the same time that you need to know all your stuff, you also have to have the confidence to walk into a situation like that and say, look, you can look at everything I write. I just need to be able to look at everything you write.
Well, I do start by saying, especially like during the interview process, although for me the interviews typically end up being, let's go meet at a bar and have a couple drinks together and then and then we'll hire you tomorrow. You know, it's typically how it is with me, which is really good. I like those kind of interviews. Typically I'll say things like, you're not going to hire me because of the successes I've had. You're going to hire me because I've seen failure and I've got the scars to show for it up and down my arm. Mm-hmm. And so when I'm actually in with the team, when I'm actually in, you know, talking to the engineers that are going to be my peers for some period of time, I can typically bring up, you know, what worked at a different company that I was at was not to do it this way, but to do it that way, because that led down to the direction of chaos and failure. And you may not see that now in not having code reviews as being a problem because you think you're all great programmers, which you are, obviously you wouldn't be working here. But I tell you, going down that path is going to lead to some destruction. So I get to be the forecaster of evil. and they'll listen to that. They're not going to listen to it as the best practices code review. They're going to listen to it as, you know, if we don't do code review and somebody misses something, we could bring down the whole production system. And that is a better sales. It seems to work a lot easier.
So I know that you are pretty experienced in several different languages, but what was it that really turned you on to Perl? Why was it Perl as opposed to any other language out there?
Well, I got involved with Perl very early on. I was coding all my stuff in, believe it or not, Emacs, Lisp, and Sed, and Awk. I've been a Unix guy since 1977 as well, so one of the early Unix adopters. And so I was working for Tektronix at the time, I think, which is the largest employer in Oregon, at least it used to be, but now it's like a tiny employer. I was coding stuff, and I'd been using Patch and RN, which are two of Larry Wall's tools, very frequently, and I love the RN man page. It's a wonder to read. If you haven't actually seen it, you can probably find Google for RN man page and go just read it. It's fun. And this Perl 1.0 came along, and back in the early days in Usenet, it came along in 45 parts that you had to download each one and make sure it got to your Usenet thing. And then you assembled parts 1 through 45 by running one of them, and it would find the rest of them and then pull itself together. And I kind of liked this Perl thing. It sort of reminded me of a Super Awk or a Super Sed, and I'd been using those quite a bit. But I did, you know, I set it aside after a while. I said, okay, this is kind of cool. I wrote some more things in Emacs Lisp and some more Sed scripts and some more Awk scripts. But Perl 2 came along, and it was about, the man page for Perl 1, I think, was about 6 pages. The man page for Perl 2 was like 15 pages. So it was getting longer, and I went, oh, it's got more features now. This is interesting. And so I pulled it down, and I started writing everything that I'd been doing in other languages. I started writing it all in Perl, and it just felt right. It had the right combination of regular expressions as a first order citizen and all the things that really fit the problems that I was solving. And so when Larry announced he was going to do Perl 3, and it was going to be big enough to actually rewrite RN in Perl, it was going to have that much feature, so it could scale well, it would have the ability to talk to sockets, it would have all sorts of binary data manipulation stuff, I went, this is cool. So he was looking for volunteers at that point, and I was a remote volunteer for him to join a testing group so that Perl 3 alpha versions would come to me, and I would make sure it ran on the systems that I had access to, and I would give feedback about the features and things like that. And it really suited me well. So actually, I started invading CompUnix questions and CompUnix shell, which were two Usenet groups back in the day. They're still there. I still hit them every once in a while, but there's a lot less traffic on them, of course. Now everybody's gone to the web. But I started invading those, and I started answering those questions that were posted there with Perl answers. And I did it enough that I actually came in one day, and somebody posted a question. At the bottom, they said, "No Perl, please." And at that point, I knew I succeeded. So I answered that question first in the shell. It was like 7 lines. And then in one line in Perl.
Wow.
And I said, this is why I'm coding in Perl, because it's less typing for me, you know? I type pretty fast, but I'd rather type less. And Perl did that for me. And so when Perl 3 for real came out, somebody suggested to Larry that they need more documentation. I mean, the man page had gone from, you know, 15 pages to over 60 pages. But they said need more documentation. And I knew what he meant. He knew that he meant that they need more tutorial information, because it was still a reference-y sort of man page. And I volunteered, raised my electronic hand again. I said, you know, I've been a tech writer for many of the last dozen years or so. That's actually how I got started. I shifted from programming to writing, and I had a whole shelf full of books at that point for other companies written, including Tektronix and stuff. And I said, I can help Larry out with something for online. And I just meant it for something online, but somebody at O'Reilly and Associates, the publishers of all the animal books, wrote me privately and said, well, if you're going to write something, we might as well publish it. And I was thrilled. I was dancing up and down. I went, oh, my God, a book with my name on the cover. This is cool. And that cemented it with me and Perl. I mean, I became now thrust in the center of the Perl community, not just one of the guys who happens to be using it. And, you know, that led to a training book deal, and that led to me running the largest Perl training company in the world for a while. Perl has been very, very good to me.
It really sounds like it was like a true calling for you. And you have books about it, too.
Yeah, well, you know, the book, again, was I didn't go around pitching a story. O'Reilly contacted me and said, we should write up what you were going to write about online. And I said, okay, that sounds like fun. I've done this before. Because, like I said, I had a shelf full of books already. Just there was ghost written for technology companies. And so it was really nice to shift into being something. It was really legitimately, you know, mine and Larry Wall's. So you're showing a picture of Learning Pearl, which is my second book, but that's okay. The first book was Programming Pearl. But Learning Pearl still outsells Programming Pearl even today. So I'm still making a few bucks. It's not as lucrative as you think it might be. At one point, I was actually making the car payment with my royalties. So
oh, wow.
It wasn't like huge. It wasn't huge, but you know what kind of car I drive.
It's totally worth it, though.
Yeah.
It made the payments on that 72 Pinto. It was fantastic.
Yeah.
That's really cool. I would love to be able to write books about programming one day. I'm still pretty far away from that part, though.
Now, Randall, let me ask you this, because we got this a lot, especially at the start of Coding 101, and I'm sure you run into this all the time. Coding, programming, and programming languages can be a little like a religion for a lot of geeks. You know, they have their favorite. They have the one that they believe is always the best solution for everything. And sometimes I hear over and over from people that everything is always better in a particular language. And we got this when we started the show, which is people were saying, well, why are you programming in C#? And it didn't matter how many times we told people, look, we're going to be moving through many different languages. The modules are going to switch. What we're really trying to show you is the thought behind the programming. We don't care what code we're using at the moment. We want to teach you are the skills you need to break down a real-world problem into something a computer can actually understand. Now, do you see that a lot? Again, I like to go back to the situation of you walking into an environment where there might be an established programming regime and saying, look, I've got a better programming language for you to do this in. I know you're really stuck on this one, but it's so much easier for you to write it in Perl, or it's so much easier for you to write it in X language. Or when you come in to a shop, do you just adopt whatever language they use?
Well, you know, I really hate MySQL, and my current client is using that rather than Postgres, like a sane person would. But you know, I'm actually going to be able to list on my resume after this gig. I'm going to be able to list optimized slow MySQL queries, and I didn't know that before. Actually, some of the people internally have actually talked about shifting to Postgres, but the problem is you've got a site that's up 24/7, and how do you migrate all your data and get everything to happen all at once? So they're probably not going to do that. Now, you say, well, would I introduce Perl to a group? Well, it turns out that my clients are sort of self-selecting, and they're hiring me because I'm the Perl expert. So luckily, everybody I've been around is using Perl. Now, there's different frameworks below or within Perl. And I've had problems with the last few clients selecting what I consider to be the wrong object relational mapper, a popular but wrong, I think, in a lot of ways. And what's funny is as I discuss the issues with them, they go, yeah, we've run into those issues. And they go, yeah, this is why I don't recommend this for green starts anymore. It's these issues. You want to be using this ORM over here, and it's a much better one. So I'm typically brought in far too far down the line to make those kinds of sweeping recommendations.
Yeah, I was about to ask you that. How many times do you actually win that argument where they say, oh, that is a better way to do it, and then they switch? It sounds
well,
to me like...
They don't switch. They're stuck. That's part of the problem is like once you're entrenched and you've got thousands of lines of code that look a particular way, all you can do is put nice wrappers around everything, and that sort of solves a few of the problems, but not the fundamental problems. But, you know... Actually, if anything, what I do is I frustrate people because I tell them, you know, there's a better way. Go look at this. And they go, oh, we should use that.
That can't be a good feeling if you're running a startup and the contractor that you've hired to come in and fix things tells you, well, yeah, you could make it work the way that you're working right now, but it'll
be
faster and better and more efficient to do it this way, but you're too far along in the process to do it.
Well, let's just say that I have to have in my contract that I will not take any piece of code, no matter how anonymized, and post it to the dailywtf.com.
Oh, that's horrible.
Because almost everything I see every day could go there.
Okay, so he mentioned this to me earlier, and I had to ask you because it was kind of weird. What is this thing called the Schwartzian transform? What is this?
I did not name that. I am not that vain. What happened is that, you know, when Perl 5 came out, one of the biggest features it had is the ability to have complex data structures that were pointers of lists that contain pointers to hashes, that contain pointers to lists and stuff. So you get this really complex data structure. Now, this made me very happy because as an Emacs Lisp guy, I had been dealing with these complex sort of structures back in the early days. And so now it was back again. So everything I knew from Lisp, I could apply now to Perl. And I was on a break during one of my teaching gigs. My teaching gigs typically last 3 to 5 days, and I would have I'd do 1 hour of lecture, 1 hour of lab, 1 hour of lecture, 1 hour of lab. So during one of the labs, I would go and check out Usenet. And somebody asked a question in the Perl group about why this was working so slowly. Why was this sort working so slowly? And I said, oh, that's because every time Perl has to compare two of the items, you're doing this complex regular expression match against one of the items. You're doing the same sort of one against the other one, and then you're comparing the pieces of those. And the problem is, of course, you don't just compare one item once. You compare it against some other things, too, to kind of figure out where it's going to go in the ultimate sort order. So you're doing the same calculation that's expensive over and over again. You really need to compute that once and then sort the original item based on this derived data from it. And I quickly code it up in a few lines of Perl. Let's say here's the original data. Here it is with its derived key. Here's the sorting based on the key, but it also moves the original data around as well. And then here's the thing stripping out the sorted key and then back to the original data. So it's like, you know, five lines of Perl. And I didn't have time to explain it much, but I went away. And the next break I came back, back online, I saw that Tom Christensen, also a fellow trainer and fellow book author, had written up this very complex analysis of what I had done. And he also pointed out that I had a bug. I actually took off the new lines in one place and forgot to put them back on in the end, but that was okay. It still worked. Just didn't work the way I wanted to. So he wrote this in like 10 or 15 different derived steps very carefully from the original problem all the way through doing it explicitly with arrays, doing it more and more implicitly until he got down to the last step. And the last step says, now let's circle back to that Schwartzian transform. Meaning it in some sort of degrading way. I actually now know this because I'll tell you in a minute how I know. I was amused by the whole posting. It was a great posting. And it explained a lot of things. It actually became part of his sort of FAQs that he would distribute with his training stuff. And then about a week later, somebody had a sorting problem. And somebody else said, in answering that, said, oh, you need a Schwartzian transform here. And then somebody else had a problem, and then somebody else answered it. Oh, you need a Schwartzian transform there. So the name started sticking. And I had nothing to do with that. And then all of a sudden, you could tell Tom must have had like fumes coming out of his ears because he said, oh, I should never have given it that clever of a name. Let's just call it the Black Transform.
Too late. Too late, right.
Black being, of course, sorry, a play on my last name, Schwartz in German. So yeah, so that was too late. Exactly. Too late.
You know, I've often found that that's really the difference between a programmer and just a coder. You know, a coder will look at a piece of code and see, does it work? Does it output what I want? Yes, I'm done. Whereas a programmer is always looking for the shortcut. A programmer is always looking for a better way to represent the problem. And it sounds to me that that's exactly what you did. You looked at something and you said, wait a minute, this is not the right mathematical way to do it. I would never do this if I was actually calculating this in my head. The way I would do it is this, and if I can think it in my head, there must be a way to express that in code. How often, when you do these contracting jobs, do you walk in thinking, well, I'm going to find all the inefficient ways that they've written X function, and I'm going to figure out a faster way to do it?
Well, that's typically what I'm getting hired for. For the last two or three clients in particular, when I would check in on Foursquare, I would say, making things go faster. I'm really, really good at having a good sense initially of just like, okay, this is inefficient here, this is inefficient here, particularly Perl code, of course, because that's what I'm most familiar with. But even things like, you know, SQL queries, things like that, I have a good sense that somebody's doing something that's a little crazy. And then I have tools I can bring in after that. But I like to say that, you know, within the first week of my most recent client, I made a 3-line code change and improved their speed of their website by 30%. But it's knowing which 3 lines to change that they hired me for. But it's the same sort of problems typically. It's like computing something too often, not caching the result of something, computing something needlessly, using inefficient algorithms, but it's not always the algorithms. It's more like just you know, not stepping back a couple steps and going, how am I really using this data? And is there a way that I can derive some of this data in a different way? I mean, you know, what wiggles what in there? You know, if I change this data, which changes over here? And can I, is there some way I can remember that so I don't have to do it only once?
Right. Now, Randall, we want to talk a little bit about something that mm-hmm. I actually asked you beforehand because I wanted to make sure you were comfortable with this.
Oh, yeah.
You are, I think, the only host on the TWiT TV network and definitely the only guest we've ever had on Coding 101 who at some point had a felony on his record.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. Now, indeed. This stemmed from a 1995 case brought against you by the state of Oregon. Not a financial case, by the way. It was actually a criminal case,
yes.
Stemming from your time as a system administrator from Intel.
Yes.
Doing some very standard system administrator stuff,
mm-hmm.
but I like to think that this is one of the very first cases in which the law didn't quite understand what people in computer science did.
It still doesn't.
Right. But this is one of the very first great examples of, wait, he got in trouble for what?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
can
yeah,
you explain
exactly.
How this happened, what happened, and then talk a little bit about how your record got expunged?
Yeah, so 1990 through 1993, actually. It's from 1987 to 1993. There we go. I was a contractor at Intel in seven different slots. One of the things about being a contractor is you're always looking for, you know, doing the items 1 through 10 that the boss wants, but also looking for item 11 that shows that you're still valuable in some way because you're bringing something to the table. You're not just being the code monkey that's doing the things that are on the table. And I would do these sort of odd projects from time to time. I'd see something that needs to be done and just go ahead and do it. And I got really practiced at that. Well, the thing that the particular thing that we have in question is I was running Crack, which is a standard tool for evaluating the strength of passwords in the Unix system. I was running Crack against the password file of the current group that I was in. Well, there was only like five passwords in there, so it didn't show up anything. Crack, I think 3.0 had just come out. So I was actually testing the new version of Crack. Again, I'd done all my stuff for the day. I thought, well, I'll try this out. Well, I still had access to the previous group, where I was one of the key system administrators, and I'd moved on to the new group, but they still gave me access previously to the previous system because I was still maintaining some code for them. And I ran Crack against this much larger password file, and something like, I forget the number now, something like 67 of the passwords were guessable. Now, this shocked me to no end because I was, when I was in that group, I was running Crack against the local password file, and I made sure, I anybody that got guessed, I would, and this was complex things like, you know, like the word hello with the E changed to a 3, it would find stuff like that, and the O changed to a 0. So it would find these sort of normal, you know, combinations of things, people's first names, pet names, things like that. It would look for all that stuff. And it was really good at doing that. I actually met the author of Crack a few years ago, cool guy. So I couldn't imagine that, you know, 67 passwords were guessable. Now, what I didn't realize at the time was one of the passwords was the vice president, and his password was president with the S changed to a dollar sign.
Oh.
And I suspect that's why I got prosecuted, because I actually embarrassed somebody. Now, I was going to go over to the group and say, you know, to the people who had taken over my job, essentially, at the other group. But I then realized, wait a second, I'm going over to tell them they're not doing their job. How do I do that? I spent a few weeks sort of kicking back, trying to figure out how to do this best. In the meanwhile, somebody at my new group noticed I was running Crack and running against the password file of the old group and didn't understand my motivation. I was just simply trying to do one of these things again where it's like, you know, the 11th item on the 1 to 10 list. And never intending any harm to anybody, not trying to do anything at all. But, you know, the problem is they showed up at my house, they took my computers away, they only returned them like 4 months later. And imagine, you know, having all your data in your computers and then not having them for 4 months. It was just really crazy. And they didn't arrest me until they put out a warrant for my arrest 4 months later, which shows you they had to figure out, okay, wait, we've accused him of being bad. He's only done exactly what he told us he was doing. Then, and with the intentions of probably that he told us he was doing it. So now what do we do? Well, it turns out Oregon's computer crime law is overbroad and vague. Basically, if I pick up your cell phone and I change the background color on the screen, that's a Class C felony, $100,000 and five years in jail. So the law is way out of proportion in this thing. And so I got basically nailed with a law that makes criminals out of anybody they want to prosecute. And I got three felonies eventually in 95 convicted on me. And it was devastating. I got to tell you, I was suicidal for a few times. Because here's the thing, you know, since 10, I wanted to be a programmer. And I said, who's going to hire me now? Mm-hmm. But luckily, I had a lot of friends come forward, and they brought me into their companies and stuff. So it was quite a transition period. And then about 10 years later, you're eligible for expungement in Oregon. So I applied for that. And so technically, I can now tell you, I've never been convicted of a crime in my life. But it doesn't matter as far as the feds go, apparently. So I can't get, like, a global early entry. I have troubles going to Australia and Canada still. I can go anywhere else in the world. Just can't go to Canada and Australia. Just very, very weird.
Of all places.
Yeah, of all places.
Now, Randall, this is interesting. You bring up a great point. And actually, I think there's a lot of programmers out there, and especially a lot of programmers who might know Snubs, because Snubs has a couple of the shows, and one of them specifically talks about security.
We've dealt with banks telling us that we can't have a checking account with them because of the name of our show. It's called mm-hmm. Hack 5, and people have told us that we can't get jobs because of the name of our show. My friend mm-hmm. had a problem getting a loan for his house because of it. And it's ridiculous how feds and how a lot of government companies look down at us just based on the fact that we know how to do these type of things. It's just kind mm-hmm. of irritating.
You know, and the thing that hits me the most is something that Randall alluded to, which is these overbroad laws, which that's one thing. If it's most laws are overbroad, they try to catch all the outliers. But the very selective way that they are applied, and it always seems as if it's not every hacker who's going to get persecuted. It's going to be the hacker who insulted or embarrassed the wrong person that the book is going to get thrown at.
Exactly.
And I know you touch on this in Floss, which is why it's a great program to watch. Even though it's early in the morning on Wednesdays at 8 o'clock on live.twit.tv, it's something that you should watch because they talk about cases like this. Well, mm-hmm. I think what I'd love to hear from you is, looking back on your experience now and knowing that there's a new generation of programmers and there's a new generation of people who are going to be curious about the networks that they're connected to, there's this little air of insecurity about, well, this seems really easy, but someone's telling me that this is a crime.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, mm-hmm. I'm on a network, and the system administrator knows absolutely nothing about security. And for some reason, I can access all the files of all the executives because it's a standard Samba share with no protection. But for some reason, if they accidentally click into one of those folders, they're now guilty of a felony.
Right.
And that could be held against them. I actually hear these stories every once in a while. I get people who have freaked out, and they're writing me saying,
me too.
I accidentally did this, and I'm afraid that someone's going to check the logs and I'm going to get fired and, mm-hmm. and persecuted. But there doesn't seem to be that much momentum. There is no political will to fix the laws that haven't caught up with technology.
And it always seems like if you're the person that's trying to help the company, you're trying to bring this problem to them and say, hey, I found this vulnerability. We need to make sure that it gets fixed. If you're the person that found that vulnerability, they're going to go after you.
Yeah, there's no safe harbor for whistleblowers in this arena, and that's part of the problem.
Not.
And also remember that the laws are written and paid for by the people who pay for our government, which is the big companies that have good lobbyists. So, of course, the laws are going to be biased towards not the individual, but towards protecting the corporation, the corporate status quo. I love you keep saying persecuted instead of prosecuted. I don't think we do much persecution these days, but it may sort of feel like it, actually, but no.
Well, I come from a background where we persecute everyone. So
exactly.
That's my preferred word. But it really is persecution, right? I mean, it's persecution of people who have an understanding of a system that others would prefer they not have.
Mm-hmm.
And what boggles my mind sometimes is when I look at these laws and when I look at how they're applied, I almost want to ask the question, are you trying to unlearn stuff?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's not possible. This knowledge is out. People will know how to do this. So your law, by its very nature, is moot. You'll never be able to enforce this the way that you want. All it looks like is a tool for revenge when someone points out you doing something stupid.
Yeah, well, I think these laws, the federal law actually was better than the state law in this case, which made it interesting, and that's why the feds didn't prosecute me, because The feds actually had a threshold, a floor threshold of must be more than $50,000 worth of damage or something like that. The state law was absolutely no floor for actual costs incurred or, you know, damage done or anything, nothing like that. I mean, just we got one of the pretrial hearings. We got a judge to admit that it just changing the background color on the screen without authorization is, in fact, within the purview of this law. And it's insane. So, I mean, that's part of the case law now for Oregon, which is that this really, really stupid thing that they roped me in with is now part of the case law in Oregon. And most Western states have almost exactly the same wording, because it turns out the phone company of the West Coast got this bill passed in something like 11 different states. And Pacific Bell, they're all broken up into other things now. But when we researched the law in Oregon, it turns out there was 15 minutes of discussion in committee and no discussion on the main floor of the Oregon legislature for this law. And it was attached to a cable theft bill. So people thought they were voting on this whole thing of protecting, you know, our fundamental infrastructure. These laws came out right after the time of the movie War Games.
Oh, no.
And I said, if they ever make a movie about my life, I got to have Matthew Broderick play me, because I think that would be the ultimate revenge for all this. I was convicted because of the law that his movie inspired, and therefore he should play me in the movie.
Shall we run a crack?
Do you want to play a game?
Now, actually, there is one little note of hope. I remember there was just a case, a federal case, I believe 2 months ago. Maybe you covered this on Floss, about a criminal complaint being dismissed against the system administrator, because even though they were able to prove that he accessed folders that he wasn't supposed to have access to, they weren't able to prove any real monetary damage. Do you see, is that a trend? Are we heading in that direction where the courts are catching up and they're realizing it's not enough just to prove that someone was poking around where they weren't supposed to be? You have to be able to prove that there was malicious intent.
But you know, it's hard to prove either a positive or negative about intent unless you look at the circumstances. I know I've been really versed in this with my case. So you really need to have some objective tests as well. That's why I said that I think the federal law is a lot better, because it has a damage floor. And we need to get legislators that write the laws like that so they can be tested. It isn't just we intend for something to happen, because it's really hard to prove intent. You can't do it. I had a jury of my peers, but you know, what do my peers mean in this case? You know, there wasn't a single computer programmer on the bench or on the in the jury. I know that because we did FOIA. We went all the way through these guys, and none of them were even close to my skill level, so they didn't understand this stuff. We brought in a lot of expert witnesses. We even had one of my expert witnesses, you know, at my expense, make this really nice movie showing what firewalls were and how passwords protect things and stuff. And the judge disallowed it because he said, because the state doesn't have the kind of money to make that kind of video. It was insane. The whole trial was just like 11 days of hell is what it was. Especially the ending, of course, since I found out I was convicted. I'm not familiar with the particular case you're talking about, but there has to have been something in the law that said there was a floor of damages, or they wouldn't have been able to drop it out. They would have just said, well, we're going to do it based on intent and stuff like that. And so we need more laws that are closer to what is actually happening. What are you really being damaged by me, you know, hitting your website or doing anything like that? By the way, just hitting a website in Oregon may be illegal based on this law, because you are altering the computer without authorization necessarily. Where's your authorization? Awesome. Where's your written authorization to visit the Oregonian's webpage? Where is it? Do you have it? Do you have it on you? No, you don't. So the Oregonian can come after you. Yes.
It takes me a lot to just sit here and not like get up on my legs and just start jumping, going, "Yeah, that's right, man! Put it to the big guy."
I'm almost sorry that we got into this, because I just want to talk about this for the next hour.
I do too.
There's
I can
so
go on and
much.
On.
You
so
can always bring me back. You know, this doesn't have to be my only appearance.
Yeah, next time we could just rant about how the law hasn't caught up with tech.
Oh yeah.
But let's move on. We get this question a lot. A ton of times we'll have our fans email us and say, I really want to get into programming, I really want to get into coding, but how do I do it? Like, where do I start? And that's a huge thing for everybody, I think.
Mm-hmm. It is. Is there a question in there?
Yes.
Was that yes or no question?
How do, well, yes. If I was just starting to get into programming, how would I get into it? Where do I start?
I think I would find something that interests you that can be broken down to a series of steps, and find a programming language that seems to fit the arena for that. I used to recommend everybody to go grab Squeak Smalltalk, which you can also do the MIT Scratch, which is similar, because it's actually based on Squeak Smalltalk underneath. But I've been having a lot of fun lately playing with the Dart programming language, and I think that's a great place to get started now. It runs in your browser. It's just hit 1.0. I think it's going to be the next big language for client-side apps, but also has a really great server-side component as well. It compiles to native JavaScript on all the modern browsers. So you can build this really complex application and then push, you know, debug it with the native tools, and then push a button, and out comes JavaScript, and it just runs. And it's really, really fun, really, really amazing. So I'd play with that. It's a decent language. It's got all the traditional stuff, like, you know, classes, libraries, objects, getters and setters that don't have a different syntax. You don't have to shift from a method call to a getter setter syntax, unlike other evil languages like Java. So it's a nice language. It's a really nice language. And since Google's behind it, and they're rewriting, I'm told by Little Bird that they're rewriting all of their major apps, like Google Mail and wow. Google Web stuff. All their major apps are going to be rewritten in this over time. So it's got some sticking power, and I'm actually going to be probably writing a book about it, maybe even doing some training classes on it, but I'm definitely, I'm already commissioned to do a commercial app in it already, so Dart seems like fun. Go check it out.
Now, both of us are pretty new to this show, doing Coding 101. Do you have any suggestions for us as hosts of the show, trying to help get people interested in programming?
Let's see. What have I yelled at the screen when I've been watching the previous shows?
Have you yelled at us at all?
I think we actually heard it. It was trickling through the chat room.
Here's the problem. I'm both a professional programmer and a professional teacher, having done all the courses that I've taught. One of the things I've learned, and I know that a lot of your shows sort of work this way, but one of the things I've learned is what to leave out. And how I say that is that, you know, everybody's starting at some place and they want to end up somewhere else. And if you draw a straight line between them, you might go, well, then I just need to know this and then this and then this and then this and then this, and then you're over at the destination. And a lot of people, when they try to write about stuff, including programming, or try to teach things, they sort of go off on these tangents all the time. So it makes it longer, and it also distracts me. Like, well, then, if I'm not quite understanding this, is this a sidetrack or is this the main line? Because if I'm not quite understanding this, will the next port just be harder? You know, is it building on this? So it's not a problem to take detours, but it really helps the listener, the student, however you're dealing with this, to inform them. Okay, just hold that thought for a moment. We're just going to go off on a little bit of a side tangent here for a second, just to kind of illustrate a couple of new principles, but you won't need this for the rest of what we're doing today.
Right.
And that really helps. If you can be very clear whether you're on the track or whether you're taking a tangent and informing the listener which of those two you're on, like, we're going to build on this, do this, this. Now you know back on the main track, right? But if like, oh, just for a moment, I want to show you something really clever about how to pass variables into a subroutine, you know. But let people know that you're taking that tangent, and it really, really helps people to stay on track.
Thank you so much for that suggestion. That was actually really good.
That's, so we're just going to tell everyone.
It's what I do.
We're going to be on a tangent for the next 8 weeks, just so you know that. Oh, Randall, thank you so very much for coming on. We're running out of time. We're running into the next show right now. But it is an absolute honor and a pleasure to have you on as a special guest. And I understand that we've already extended an invitation for you to teach our audience all about Java, which is a programming language you love.
Stab me.
We were hoping for that. But if you could tell our audience where they can find you. Of course, they could find you every Wednesday morning at 8 o'clock on Twit TV for Floss. But where else can they find you?
Oh, my God, all over the net. If you Google for my name, I think it's like 1.4 million web pages that mention me now. I'm most frequently posting to Google Plus is Randall L. Schwartz. You can check for me there. I talk about typically about programming, a lot of humor things there. I also talk about my incredible health increase and weight loss through low-carb, high-fat. I post a lot of articles related to that, non-conventional wisdom in terms of nutrition. But I also tweet at Merlyn, M-E-R-L-Y-N. I'm at twit.tv/floss for the Floss Weekly Show. And I'm everywhere. If you just mention me somewhere on the net, I'll probably find you because I have all these little spies that go around and check for things for me. So it's cool.
There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. That's Randall Schwartz, the bad boy of Twit TV. Thank you so much. Now remember, you can always find out more about our show, Coding 101, by going to our show page. Just go to twit.tv/code or Coding 101, and you'll find all of our episodes along with our show notes, along with the code repository, so you can follow along with us when we do our actual coding episodes. And it's a nice way for you to jump in and make sure that you understand when we are on topic and when we're leading off into one of those tangents.
That's so very true. And you can also find us over at Google, over at our Google Plus community. That's gplus.to/twitcoding101. And I also just put us on Twitter as well. I don't know if I told you that.
Yeah, we're
on
the tweeters.
BTW, we're on Twitter now. Yeah. It's at twitcoding101. Super easy to remember. So you can find us over there, and you can ask us all sorts of questions if you'd like.
And it's not just G Plus, and it's not just Twitter. You can also find us on the YouTubes. Go to youtube.com/twitcoding101. And again, you'll be able to find all of our episodes. And that's also where we're going to be doing announcements of any special events that we've got coming up in Coding 101. And there are events coming up because we're approaching that time of year where we get an influx of Google I.O. and Maker Faire and all of the little things that may not fit into a regular episode of Coding 101. So make sure you subscribe. Make sure you check back. Make sure you watch us on the YouTubes.
And last but not least is our Twitter accounts. You can find me over at Twitter. I'm twitter.com/snubs. And Padre is...
at Padre SJ. I also wanted to make sure everyone knew that next week we're getting back into coding. We had our 2 weeks of wild card. We had our 2 weeks of awesome. But now we need you to learn. And we've got a special guest. Our new code warrior is Shannon.
Woohoo! My very, very good friend and now kind of a coworker as well. His name is Dale Chase. He works over at Revision 3, a.k.a. Discovery Digital Media, and he is going to be our Python expert.
Python.
Yay!
So, and the reason why we chose Python is because we wanted to give you something that you could use on those brand new Raspis that you're going to be buying. We know you're going to get them. Mm. Also, please don't forget that we do this show live every Thursday at 1:30 p.m. Pacific. You can join us at live.twit.tv. And as long as you're watching us live, why not jump into our chat room at irc.twit.tv? It's part of the experience. You'll see us drawing from the chat room. You'll see us answering questions. It's how you can interact with us as we're teaching you the secret foo of the code monkey.
That about ends this episode today. It was a good one. We really enjoyed talking to Randall Schwartz as well. And I'll go ahead and end this one with end of line. Bye!